It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with a marine biologist who warns that our oceans may be on the cusp of mass extinction. We'll find out what can be done to prevent that. First, the governor released details of his budget plan as it relates to the University of Wisconsin system. Next week, he'll formally propose a budget cut of $300 million over the next 2 years. A tuition freeze would still be in effect on all UW campuses, but the governor says the cuts come with increased flexibility for the UW. We do want to mention as a note of disclosure that Wisconsin Public Radio is partly funded via the UW system. Sean Johnson joins us now to outline some of the details of the governor's proposal. He's WPR's state government reporter. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So two main parts to what the governor said today, the money, we'll get to that in a moment, and the structure, the governance. The proposal would turn the UW system into a public authority. What would that mean?
Yeah, a public authority, you know, we don't have the budget in front of us yet. This is based on a press release from the governor and interview he gave to the AP and then some comments to reporters today. But from what we know about the authority, it would be an independent governing board, independent from the legislature and the governor when it comes to setting its own budgets. And so the UW would get a block grant from the state, a set amount of funding that would go up, in subsequent years based on some kind of tie to inflation, and it'd be up to that UW Board of Regents, which is now independent, now the UW System Authority, to decide how to spend that. So that piece of the equation the UW likes a lot. They've wanted that level of independence for years, given that the state is providing the university with a smaller and smaller piece of their budget as a percentage. The UW wants more freedom on how to spend it.
And that would also loosen up some of the state restrictions, you know, things that might apply to other state departments. It would loosen that up when it comes to this public authority university system.
Yeah, they can decide what they want to do when it comes to procurement, when it comes to salaries. I mean, that's something that you hear the university talk about quite a bit, is that because they don't have the freedom to set their salaries, they feel the way that they feel like they should, they're falling behind the salaries that are offered in other competing institutions. So, you know, those are things that the university likes about this idea. And, you know, one note about this is similar to something the governor proposed in 2011, but that was just for the UW-Madison. And so you had, all the other campuses really pushed back against this, and that, you know, that proposal went away relatively quickly. This is something that would cover the entire UW system, so a much bigger deal here.
So the UW system, you said, likes the basics of that idea. On the other hand, $300 million over the next 2 years in cuts for the state portion of the funding for the university, about a 13% reduction. What does that mean in terms of service or operation changes as far as what we know from what the UW has responded so far?
Yeah, it is a big, on the other hand, when you look at that $300 million cut, consider the fact that the UW system was asking for an increase of $95 million. And, you know, you look back at the last budget, the UW system, after there was much talk about the sizable reserves that the system had, sizable cash balances that it had at departments throughout the state, lawmakers cut their funding, they froze tuition. And so this budget, not only do you have another tuition freeze, you have this $300 million cut. And so university officials are saying, when you consider it like that, this is actually the biggest cut that the university has faced. Because, you know, typically a university has, to oversimplify, a few ways to get money. They can get it from the state. They can get it from private donations. They can get it from tuition. You take that tuition option away from them and you cut the state funding, and, you know, extra freedom, more autonomy or not, that's going to put them in a pinch.
Looking at the different universities here in the system, UW-Madison gets a lot more of its money from outside the state, federal things, grants, probably those donations. Is this something that could potentially be a bigger hit for all the other schools in the system?
Yeah, I don't know, and I guess it would kind of depend on how the UW Board of Regents was structured, since they'll be the ones that are making the calls, and these are people that are appointed, most of them, by the governor right now. You know, I don't know if that would change dramatically under this proposal and his budget, but it seems like this new Board of Regents, the way that it would be constructed under the governor's budget, not only would it have this freedom from the legislature and the governor to kind of set their own budget, they would, in theory, they would have freedom to determine, you know, how to shift that around between campuses. And even when it came to tuition increases, from what we know of this, it seems to open the door to having tuition increases be larger for certain majors than for others. So if the university knows that a certain major is in high demand, they could say, all right, you're going to have to pay a little bit more to study this than you would, I don't know, say journalism.
Now, this is a proposal from the governor, actually a preview of a proposal. We'll see the real deal in the budget proposal next week. That would then have to go into the legislature. Is there any sense that the Republican majorities in both houses would see this as a slam dunk and sign off on this, or do you see debate in the works here?
I don't see it as a slam dunk by any means. I haven't heard a lot of reaction from Republican lawmakers thus far. I mean, Speaker Robin Voss is going to be a critical voice in this debate. You know, he oversees the large majority in the GOP assembly, and he's been very outspoken against many of the policies of the university and has talked about changes he wants to see there. You know, he took a little bit, for him, a little bit of a wait-and-see approach, saying that he still needed to talk it over with members of his caucus. So that's kind of a hint that it's not a slam dunk. You look at what now Senator Steve Noss has said, and he was a representative before this, and I'd say over the last decade anyway, he's been the most outspoken critic of the University of Wisconsin. He did not like this plan. His basic problem is that it takes control over the university away from the public, in his mind, by taking it away from the legislature, and that you'd have this unelected Board of Regents have the power to increase tuition, and that, you know, maybe you have this tuition freeze now for this budget that allows the governor to fulfill a campaign promise. But if that tuition freeze goes away in the next budget and the university feels like it took quite a hit in this budget and needs to make that up, Noss says that could come in the form of a huge tuition increase. And this is something that Democrats have echoed as well, that, you know, you're just setting the university up for a big tuition increase in the future.
So it seems like there's two main lines of debate that can make this complicated. One is over the size and extent of the cuts in state funding, and the other is giving up control of the system, the legislature giving up control of the UW system.
Yeah, I think, and the giving up control of the system would be there whether you propose this in a good budget year or a bad. I mean, lawmakers don't like to give up that control. But the funding definitely introduces a new element. I mean, the fact is the governor's proposing this in what would be a very difficult financial budget, as he's also proposing it. So, yeah, you cut the university's budget by $300 million in this biennium. That's $150 million each year. Suddenly, the university has freedom to raise tuition when it's been frozen for 4 years and when the university has seen budget cuts. And in a couple years, you know, of course, they're going to entertain a tuition increase to make some of that up.
So as you cover this story or this part of the whole budget story, what do you have your eye on next as this unfolds?
Well, I mean, we're starting to hear more about the university's response to this right now. They're telling reporters that this would no doubt result in layoffs at university institutions throughout the state. So I think you look at how the university presents this to the legislature, since the budget's going to be in their hands for a few months now. And I'd look to see what GOP lawmakers in particular have to say about this plan, since, you know, they are going to have an opportunity to make some big changes to the governor's budget should they want to. They have in previous budgets proposed by the governor when it comes to the University of Wisconsin.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson. He's WPR's state government reporter talking about the governor's proposed budget cuts for the UW system. Scientists issued a dire warning in the latest issue of the journal Science. Ocean wildlife may be facing a mass extinction. According to new research, humans have profoundly decreased the abundance of marine life, large and small, and it could have a cascade of damaging effects on ocean ecology. Some good news, though, it might not be too late to turn things around. Douglas McCauley was the lead author of this study. He's an assistant professor and marine biologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Douglas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me on today.
Now, you say when we compare ocean animals to land animals, there's a relatively low rate of extinction in the oceans right now, but it may be a prelude to a similar big extinction in the seas. Why is that?
Yeah, that's precisely it. So if we actually look at the numbers on land, they're really quite frightening. So a lot of scientists have sort of summed up the rate of extinction on land as building towards the sixth mass extinction. And so that's just a way to state that the rates of extinction are now coming close to historical extinction rates that we saw millions of years ago and some of the truly life-changing events on the planet, that humans are actually, on land at least, beginning to take on the form of an asteroid impact in terms of their impact on wildlife. So the story in the oceans seems to be a bit different and a happier status. So in the past 500 years on land, we've seen 500 animal extinctions, 500 animal species go totally extinct. In the oceans, in the same time period, we've only seen 15 animal extinctions. So why is that, right? You know, as you say, I think a large reason for that is that humans have just been a bit slower at getting into the oceans and doing the same thing that we've done to terrestrial ecosystems and terrestrial wildlife. And we're a terrestrial animal ourselves, and so we're just a bit behind the curve in terms of hunting and damaging marine habitats. And that gives us a chance also, as you say, for recovering this damage, this early damage that we see in this report.
And you just said the two key phrases, I think, hunting and damaging habitats. Which is the bigger problem? Is it, you know, we hear about overfishing sometimes. Is that a main cause in potential extinction, or is it habitat change?
Those are the two drivers that we examine in this paper, and there's actually an interesting relationship between the timing that these drivers line themselves up. So there's actually a lot to be learned by looking to the history of the way that we've impacted wildlife on land to counterintuitively get a sense of how we may impact wildlife in the oceans and how actually to chart a better future for wildlife in the oceans. So what happened on land was we began hunting animals directly. You know, we needed fur, we needed meat. Then we switched over to actually hunting their homes, to degrading habitats, to drawing the same resources out of terrestrial space that these animals, these terrestrial wildlife themselves needed. And that we saw those rates of habitat degradation spike about the same time as the terrestrial industrial revolution. Now, exactly that same time that we were switching over to building out our cities onto terrestrial wildlife habitat, drawing out resources and degrading land animal habitat, we saw a major spike in extinction rates. Now, where we are in the oceans seems to still be at phase one, hunting animals. So the reports you see largely that summarize our impacts on marine fauna, on sharks, on tuna, on whales, are focused on describing the impacts of overfishing, our harvest or our hunting of these animals. But what is a little bit frightening for us and what we describe directly as a potential transition point in the health of the oceans is that we're switching now, it seems, from hunting the animals to degrading their habitats. We may be looking at this same sort of phase transition in the oceans that we saw occur on land with very frightening consequences for extinction of terrestrial land animals.
Well, obviously we're not building our cities out in the middle of the ocean. So what human behaviors, what human impacts are degrading habitats in the oceans?
Right. So we review a bunch of different indicators of growth in marine industry. And, you know, in the United States, of course, we're not building out many cities or communities into the oceans. But in other parts of the world, particularly in places that are land-stressed, they are actually building suburbs, airports, military installations directly into the oceans. So that's happening elsewhere, not so much here in the United States. But what is happening along our coastlines, both east and west, is a change in the rate that we're taking forward marine industry. So we're farming, for example, we're farming with much greater intensity now in the oceans than we ever did before. You know, the as I was saying, in sort of phase one, this hunting phase in the oceans, most of our meat, most of the fish, the seafood that we took from the oceans came from things that we wild harvested. This is sort of free-range marine meat, right? Now it looks like projections for the world, at least, say that in the next 20 years or so, we're going to be taking more of our meat from aquaculture, from marine farming, than we do from marine hunting. So aquaculture is growing gangbusters across the world, even in the United States. There are a lot of other marine industries sort of taking off. Another one that we want to keep our eye on, I think, that scientists and ocean managers want to keep a close watch on is marine mining. So we've actually laid out stakes across the seafloor the same way that we laid out stakes on land during some of these mining rush periods. There actually seems to be a sort of gold rush underway in the ocean, not for gold, but for other more rare minerals. We've laid out stakes for mining and about 1 million square kilometers of seafloor. And next year, or potentially even this year, we may start mining that sections of those sections of seabed. Other industry, includes building power plants, modifying ocean habitats and coastal habitats for life and infrastructure on the coast, and sort of list goes on and on. And when we look at all this industry, it's not only that there's more and new kinds of industry, the rates at which we're developing our oceans in each of these different industrial categories are going way up, have been going way up in the past decade.
A listener named Michael called wondering how mass extinctions of the ocean could affect global warming. I want to flip that and hear it both ways. Is global warming, climate change, playing a role in this potential for animal extinctions in the ocean? And could there be a feedback effect if we see these extinctions? Does it change our climate change situation?
Right. Well, let me take it first. Climate change's role in influencing marine animal health. That's there's actually answers for both sides, and I'm glad we actually get to talk about both sides of this coin. But traditionally, and the largest concern among scientists and managers of the oceans right now is, how is climate change actually going to be impacting the health of marine wildlife? And there's lots of things that we can do to the oceans to help rehabilitate, to help sort of avoid this sixth mass extinction from spreading from land into our oceans, build larger marine parks, be more careful about which species we harvest. But all of these actions, if we don't pay attention directly to climate change, will not be enough. So what climate change is doing is it's heating up the oceans, and it's also acidifying the oceans. And anyone who keeps a fish tank knows that if you turn the temperature knob up a bit on your tank and pour even acid into the water for some unknown reason, that will cause your fish to not fare well, right? That's what climate change is doing to the oceans, and marine wildlife are having a very difficult time coping with this increased temperature and these rapid rates of marine acidification. Now, to sort of look at it from the other perspective, there are actually a handful of wildlife that we know that indeed affect carbon cycling in the oceans and may actually be playing a role in carbon sequestration. So one good example is sea otters, right? We think of them as being cuddly, cute parts of ocean biodiversity. Well, it seems that their effects, they're voracious predators, right? Their effects on herbivorous invertebrates, so things like sea urchins, by mowing down these sea urchins, they actually facilitate the growth of kelp forest communities here along the west coast of the United States. And that kelp forest, just like forests on land, sequesters quite a lot of carbon. So, in addition to being sort of a neat, charismatic addition to biodiversity in the oceans, these things are actually facilitating carbon sequestration, which may be slowing the advance of climate change.
Now, you're based in California. We're based here in Wisconsin, about as far as you can get from oceans. Oceans aren't necessarily on our radar here. Why should we be worried? Why should we be looking to be part of the solution to the problems you're talking about?
Well, a lot of the things we do in any part of the planet, in Wisconsin or otherwise, influence the oceans quite directly. So, as we're just talking about climate change, you wouldn't think, as a citizen of Wisconsin, what you choose or how you choose to commute to work will influence oysters off the East Coast or tropical fishes in Central America. But indeed, actually, they do. So all of our decisions we make in our everyday lives about how we use carbon and use energy help to determine whether climate change is going to speed up or whether we're going to effectively be able to slow this thing down, to slow the momentum of climate change down. And those kinds of decisions in aggregate made by people in all of our states will help to determine whether these rates of warming and these rates of acidification are going to go so fast that ocean animals can't adapt, or whether they're going to proceed slowly enough that adaptation can take place. And we see this wonderful capacity for marine wildlife actually to deal with some of this stress, just so long as it doesn't happen too quickly. Another thing that is completely relevant, to somebody in Wisconsin is what we buy. So we're consumers. All of us are consumers. Many of us, most of us, are consumers of wild ocean animals. You know, this is seafood, right? So there are counterintuitively, counter to what we see in our terrestrial meat section, you know, the poultry section, the beef section, you would never find an endangered animal sitting in one of those sections of your supermarket or sitting on a menu in a restaurant. You wouldn't find bald eagle in the poultry section or offering in your favorite chicken restaurant. But we actually see bald eagles, essentially, of the oceans turning up in your seafood section, in your sushi restaurants.
And we'll leave it there. Douglas, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet, Rob. Thank you very much.
That's marine biologist Doug McCauley of the University of California, Santa Barbara, the lead author of a new study that says our oceans may be on the verge of a mass extinction. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Let's set the scene. A suspect in a high-profile crime goes to trial. The case was all over the headlines. It had tragic, shocking consequences. Everybody has seen this story and seen the alleged perpetrator's face in newspapers, websites, on TV. So how do you find jurors who don't already have their minds made up, who aren't biased because of what they've seen in the news? That story is playing out now twice. The trial of the alleged Boston Marathon bomber has been going through the jury selection process this month, interviewing over 1,300 potential jurors. That's on hold till Thursday due to the blizzard. And a court sent out 9,000 initial summons for jurors in the Aurora, Colorado theater shootings. Dean Strang is here in the studio to help us sort things out. He's shareholder in Strang Bradley LLC. That's a Wisconsin-based criminal defense law firm. He's also the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Dean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, let's get to the average criminal case first. Without this kind of high-profile media presence, how complicated is jury selection usually?
Well, Let's start by understanding that the average criminal case in state court anywhere in this country is probably these days between 1 and 3 or 4 days long. Mm-hmm. So jury selection in an average case might be expected to take half a day or a day if you have an indulgent judge. And for most cases, all or most of the jury panel will be blissfully unaware of any of the allegations in the case. So it really, in the average case, is a process simply of deciding who physically can serve, who's going to be so distracted because mom's in the hospital or the kids have the flu or whatever, or who's got some really strong predisposition one way or the other in the case, because usually of a relative in law enforcement or a bad experience with the police themselves or whatever. It's not terribly complicated in the average or in the mine run criminal case.
And do we usually worry about a potential juror being familiar with the facts in the case based on media reports? If I've followed the reporting on this, even though it wasn't a high profiling, is that in an ordinary case? I'll throw quotes around ordinary there. I'm sure they're all a little different. Is that something that an attorney on either side might worry about?
Yes. And it certainly gives the judge and both of the lawyers something to talk about with jurors, something to probe. But that in itself is usually not terribly hard. First of all, we need a lot of exposures to a story before even the basic details of it begin to sink in or stay with us. And second, most Americans, today are willing to acknowledge, at least superficially, that much of what they read in the media often turns out to be wrong eventually or unreliable in some way. So it's certainly something to explore with potential jurors if they've had any exposure to the allegations or underlying facts in the media, but it doesn't necessarily rule them out.
So let's take it to the opposite extreme of these two cases that triggered this discussion, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Aurora shooting. People have had repeated exposure in the media. Virtually everyone has heard of these things, probably saw repeated stories, especially soon after the incident. Is there some kind of view that we can get a juror who is less familiar, who hasn't been bombarded with that in a case like this?
Well, I don't know that you're looking for, realistically, that you're looking for jurors with no familiarity in either the Aurora, Colorado case or the Boston federal trial. What you're hoping, and you may be kidding yourself, but at least what you're hoping to get is jurors who are willing to sift out the information they've heard before and come into the courtroom carrying, and at least to go through the mental exercise of trying to decide the case based on what they hear in the courtroom. Now, again, that may be a deceit on the part of the justice system and the people who participate in it, but at least that's the idea, not that you come in, pure and devoid of any knowledge about anything, but rather that you can put in context and set aside what you've heard and try to focus on what you're going to hear in the courtroom.
Now, let's look at the how here. And I understand rules vary from state to state and then into federal courts as well, but who decides whether a jury needs to, or a potential juror needs to be removed from the pool? How do they do that?
The judge ultimately makes that decision. There are two types of strikes essentially at work in this country in either state or federal court. One is a strike for cause, that is removing a juror because there's some good cause why the juror can't or shouldn't sit. That could be a bad back. That could be vacation plans that have been made earlier. That could also be, a bias or a predisposition about the case that the juror really can't set aside. There are also then peremptory strikes, the strikes typically for which a lawyer need not give any reason at all, and there's a limited number of those. But in the first instance, we're really talking about removing jurors for cause. The lawyers on either side can suggest to the judge that there's cause to remove a juror. The lawyers may agree on that or not, but the judge makes the decision in the end.
Now, you've been a defense attorney. Is it an art or a science of deciding which juror may be bad for your side and trying to get them either make that peremptory challenge or get them challenged for cause?
People have tried to make it a science. People have thought of it as an art. I don't think it's either or ever will be either quite. It's a craft in a sense, no pejorative connotation intended there. And I think the craft of sort of deciding who you don't want on your jury really has a lot to do with listening closely to the jurors, watching for nonverbal communication, and coming in as a lawyer with a pretty good feeling for where the community probably is, where at least where the center of gravity, if you will, in the community probably is on your case, whether you're prosecuting or defending.
Now, some complicating factors in these big cases, Boston Marathon and the Aurora shootings, the death penalty is a potential outcome here. Is that something that's going to weigh on who gets selected or ousted as a juror?
Hugely. Hugely, both practically and legally. In any case in which the prosecution is seeking death as the punishment, the prosecution has a right to exclude from the jury anyone whose opposition to the death penalty is so strong that they would never impose it under any circumstance. In other words, that a juror who just simply can't follow the law in terms of the aggravating and mitigating circumstances that she's to consider in deciding the penalty if in fact guilt is first proven beyond a reasonable doubt, if that juror simply can't consider imposing the death penalty if that's what the evidence warranted, the prosecution is entitled to have that juror or potential juror excluded. It's a more limited right of the defense to have excluded any juror who automatically would impose the death penalty if, for example, murder is proven beyond a reasonable doubt, if guilt is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So in theory, as a legal matter, you need to have jurors who, whatever their opinion about the death penalty, are at least willing to consider imposing it if the facts warrant it, or imposing a sentence less than death, typically life without parole, if the mitigating circumstances warrant that.
Now, some controversy in the Boston area. Apparently, some potential jurors being rejected because they're Catholic, Catholic teaching opposed to the death penalty. Uproar among the famously large Catholic population in the Boston area, the people from which this jury pool is being selected. I mean, is that a broader brush, I guess, than we usually paint with when we're selecting jurors?
That would be an unlawfully broad brush if, in fact, Judge O'Toole is doing it that way, and I suspect he's not. But, for example, Catholic teaching and one's adherence to Catholic teaching would be not only a permissible but an essential aspect of the jury questioning process here. Ordinarily, it would not. Ordinarily, my religious views are mine and not the business of a court or any lawyer. But here, not because you're a Catholic qua Catholic, but exploring your moral views on the death penalty is not only legitimate but essential in picking a jury in a capital case. Now, you're right. I mean, Boston is a heavily Catholic community. Boston is also situated in a state that abolished the death penalty 31 years ago. Now, the Tsarnaev case is in federal court, and we have a federal death penalty, irrespective of what state law may be in Wisconsin or Massachusetts or Texas or anywhere else. So the death penalty is on the table in that federal trial, and both sides in the court will have to explore very carefully whether, all right, you're Catholic, and you may subscribe wholly to the teachings of your church, but do you understand that civil rules govern this proceeding, and are you willing to follow the law in considering whether to apply the death penalty or not?
We're talking to attorney Dean Strang about the challenges of selecting a jury, especially in high-profile cases like the Boston Marathon bombing and the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. What do you want to see from jurors in these high-profile cases? Have you been on a jury or been knocked off the list for some reason? What was that like? And attorneys and judges, call in and share your thoughts on jury selection. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Wisconsin attorney Dean Strang. We're talking about the challenges of picking a jury in high-profile cases. There are two big ones going on right now. Courts are trying to find jurors in the Boston Marathon bombing trial and the trial of the accused Aurora, Colorado theater shooter. Four digits of people being considered for these juries over time. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how all this works, how juries are selected, how people are removed from the pool, or have you experienced it firsthand as a potential juror? an attorney, a judge, or a defendant, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. Dean, turning mainly to the case in Colorado now, it's likely, it seems, that a not guilty by reason of insanity may be the main issue here. Is that something that goes into the jury selection process?
Sure. As I understand the Aurora case, there's no real question about whether James Holmes killed these 12 people. A theater full of people watched mm-hmm. him do it. He did plead not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, mm-hmm. insanity, please, so to speak. And so jurors will have to be screened by both sides on whether they're willing to consider such a defense and whether they understand that the success of such a defense probably will leave him in a mental, locked mental facility for the rest of his life anyway, not, you know, out on a sidewalk near you. Mm-hmm. So that's absolutely something that the judge and both sides will be screening in that case.
And is it the case that if somebody expresses skepticism over that plea in general, that they might be removed from the jury pool?
They might, depending on the strength of that skepticism or their willingness to abide the instructions that the judge will give on what the law is, regardless of what their opinions about it may be.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Sandy on the line in Port Washington. Sandy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sandy?
Pardon?
Go ahead.
Okay. I was on a jury. It took 3 months. It was in California. And we had, like, three men on trial. And they tried them all at once. Sometimes all the jury was in at the same time, sometimes not. Now, it was interesting in the selection how people would really emphasize how they're against the death penalty and all that. And I just kind of lay back and thought, oh, I'm not going to get selected. But I did. And I tell you, it was very, very educational. What was interesting is just how hostile some jurors are. I felt like I was picked on a bit, to be honest with you.
Sandy, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Dean in on this. A couple of interesting points there. First of all, she mentioned that she was on this jury for 3 months. You were telling me before we got started that this case in Colorado, they're saying it was going to go till the fall, October or something like that. How does that duration play into jury selection?
Well, it makes me wonder whether the criminal justice system ought to be pleading insanity, to be honest with you. In the Colorado case, they're talking about jury selection going 5 months or more, just jury selection. And then keeping those jurors who are selected until October. That's an unreasonably long process, and it seriously distorts the type of juror, the person you're going to be able to get. I mean, who among us has nothing to do on his or her calendar between now and October? So, you know, you get people in these very, very long, arduous trials who, you know, are really not a cross-section of the community as a whole. And either they want terribly to serve for some reason, or they're simply not facile enough, if we're going to be honest about this, to say something that they know will get them excused from service.
Sandy, thanks a lot for that call. And I think the interpersonal dynamics of a jury might be a subject for another show sometime. Joe is with us now in Oconomowoc. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm up for jury selection sometime in the near future, and I'm curious about how the more low-key jury trial selections go. Like, what are the first few questions that are asked by the judge and attorneys to weed the obvious ones out right away?
And Joe, before we let you go and have Dean answer, are you hoping to get on the jury or hoping to weasel out of it?
I'm really excited to be on the jury. I'm very interested.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Dean, what are some of the first things that is, so if I'm in a jury pool, what are the, and I get up to the front there, what are the first things I hear?
Well, first, Joe, let me be a good lawyer here and tell you, you're going to be under oath when you're on that jury panel. And whatever you do, tell the truth. That's the first and main thing. But what you'll hear initially from the judge are the sorts of just mundane things that I have described here. Do you have a vacation scheduled? Is it a particularly busy time at work? Do you have a sick spouse or parent for whom you're the only caregiver? In other words, things going to the question of whether you really can focus on the case, concentrate on the case, and be there every day through it. After that, not the judge so much, but the lawyers in a state court case will get into your attitudes about the issues, whatever they may be, that the trial, whether it's civil or criminal, may raise and require people to think about.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good luck going through the process. As we wrap up, Joe was saying he hopes to do this educational experience. That's what we heard from our other caller. This is going back to the Greeks. This is an important part of civic life. Briefly, your thoughts on that, Dean.
It remains an important part of civic life. I mean, in this country, at least, we entrust justice in the end to people who are outsiders to the justice system. And for my money, that's the saving grace, is that the insiders don't, in the end, get to decide a case that people have decided to try.
Dean, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Dean Strang. He's a shareholder in Strang Bradley LLC, a criminal defense law firm. He's the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Right now, over at the Central Time Facebook page, we are looking for your suggestions for great winter reads, a book that we could seriously hunker down with, something that helps us get through the last month or so of real winter time. We've already been getting great suggestions from our WPR coworkers. Here's a sample of what we've heard so far. Larry Mueller, you know him. He recommends Cinnamon and Gunpowder. Here's a summary. It's 1819. Renowned chef is kidnapped by the ruthless pirate Mad Hannah Mabbott. He'll be spared if she makes him or he makes her a great meal every Sunday without fail. Pirates and food, that sounds like a good combination. Gilman Halstead went with nonfiction, There Was and There Was Not. That's the title. The author, Malin Toumani. It's about the child of Armenian immigrants to the United States who goes to Turkey to try to find out why Turks refused to acknowledge the Armenian genocide between 1915 and 1920. Some serious heavy reading there. And Paul Breen recommends The Club Dumas by Arturo Perez Reverte, a great author. I've read a bunch of his thriller, mystery, historical things. Brings together two mysteries. He says, if you like Dan Brown, this will level you up. We'll get more of your suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page and your calls later in the show.